Welcome to I'm Spiritual, Dammit. I'm your host, Jennifer Weigel, and joining me in studio, best-selling author Carolyn Mace. In studio, Carolyn, thanks for taking time out in your very busy schedule to chat with us.
Anything for you.
Oh, are you the best? Telling you, I have so enjoyed our conversations over the years, and the first time I had the pleasure of meeting you was when you were launching Sacred Contracts, and I was a reporter at CBS at the time. And I sat down and interviewed you at Transitions Bookstore. May it rest in peace.
Wow.
Remember Transitions?
Wow.
And you, Anatomy of the Spirit was one of the first books I picked up and really kind of had on the nightstand with the dog-eared pages. Mm-hmm. And it was revolutionary for me and obviously for millions because it just is celebrating its 20th anniversary.
That's right. A 20th anniversary edition's coming out.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That holding up, and I remember I asked you, do you think that what you wrote back then 20 years ago still stands today? And you say, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Boy, does it ever. And so now traveling the globe and talking in our current climate of all these different layers of the onion, I was also flipping through some various transcripts of interviews that we've had. We've had you at Conversations with Weigel up at the Wilmette Theater, and we've covered all sorts of topics from politics to energy to aliens, but there are some wonderful things as well. I want to tell a story where the last time you were here at the Tribune Tower, which is where we record these podcasts, I was a columnist with the Chicago Tribune, and the day we had planned to have dinner, I had just been told that my services would no longer be needed. And I was pretty blindsided by the news because I was doing, I thought, really good work and thought I was a much-needed member of the team because I had video experience, and we were told they were going to go down that path and blah, blah, blah. So when I called you afterwards, and it was kind of had the wind knocked out of me, you said, oh, we don't have to do this today. I said, oh, no, we got to do this today. I don't know if I can get in the building in 2 weeks. Let's do it. So I walked out to the river, and I looked out at the river, and I was cursing God, as people do when they feel sorry for themselves. And I thought, why is this happening? I'm a mom, I need to pay my bills, help. And I heard this little whisper, and it wasn't just a little whisper. It was a very clear voice that said, we had to do this. You got comfortable there. We have plans for you. And I looked behind me like, is there a homeless guy talking to me, right? Mm-hmm. That's how clear it was. And it was definitely another voice. It wasn't me. It wasn't a homeless person. And you talk about gut versus God. And when people say, oh, my gut told me this. And there's a very distinct difference between one's gut and between God. Can you help the listener discern that difference and how you explain people to better understand when something is coming from their instincts to survive and when something is coming from a source outside themselves that's greater than themselves?
The survival instinct is kicks into gear and you can act on it. And well, first of all, Jennifer, I want to begin by saying what a pleasure it is to do this interview with you.
Thank you.
Secondly, I don't think you realize how much you do. You know, to listen to you're a journalist and you're a writer and your books are wonderful. You do media. Mm-hmm. You're this multi-talented, incredible success.
Thank you.
And someone, you know, I need to acknowledge that it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be interviewed by you.
Thank you so much.
You know, so this is not a one-way street here. It's an absolute pleasure to be interviewed with you. And that, and finally, I'm going to say this, that you have just a superb intellect. You are so well-educated. I mean, and why I say that is your questions are always so sharp. And so, I mean, I've been interviewed by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it's very uncomfortable to be interviewed by someone who's been assigned to interview you.
Oh, yeah.
And they haven't read your work.
No.
and they're just like, so tell me about your book.
Right.
And was it, okay, thanks. And that's, you know, right. It's your life's work.
Back
right?
to you. Yes,
right.
Yes, and yes.
So let me just say that.
Thank
okay?
you.
Okay.
Yes.
So, all right. Now, it's funny, and I just finished a workshop on medical intuition with my dear colleague and beloved friend, Norm Shealy.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done a, you know, I've talked about intuition forever and ever, and gut instinct is what we're just born wired. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of what I would call a misunderstanding or
misconceptions
or whatever about intuition. The gut instinct is an animal instinct, mm-hmm. and we respond to it and we don't even realize it. I mean, it's the gut instinct that, you know, you don't cross the street or whatever, and you don't even think about it. It's just a gut. You don't have to invoke anything. You're not, I mean, gamblers have great gut instincts. Criminals have great, you know, this is a house I could get away with robbing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not anything of an elegant version, spiritually elegant. But that next level of intuitive refinement is your conscience, because you have a dialogue with that. Mm-hmm. There's an awareness that says, is this right or is this wrong? You have a sense of consequence, mm-hmm. that now is added to the mixture, that there's a consequence to my behavior here, mm-hmm. or to my actions. Either consequence includes another person, or it includes the police, or it includes something to my body. If I eat this, I'm diabetic and it's a bunch of sugar, something's going to happen here.
Right.
Then we evolve a little bit more. And that is when we invoke guidance. Mm-hmm. Because with conscience, there's not necessarily an invocation. You're not necessarily saying, is this morally accurate?
Right.
Am I ethically in a tight spot here? That sense of good and bad, right and wrong, what you might think of as the content of the Ten Commandments, is really the mindset of conscience. But the next level, where you invoke something, where you begin to question the structure of the universe, that it's not just right or wrong, good or bad. It's not a polarity system, mm-hmm. that there's something a bit more complicated here, that it's more mysterious than simply polarities, where things can happen out of sequence, out of your plans for your own life. Like, you can be released from a job that you thought you would have for the next 25 years, or that your marriage can break apart, or that something can happen. I did not plan for this.
Right.
That sends you out on a bridge looking into the sky saying, "What? Who's in charge here? Mm-hmm. Did I do something? I thought bad things only happen to bad people. Bad things do not happen to good persons. I am a good person. How did a bad thing happen to me?" Well, you look up into the heavens and you think, how is it that my child died before me? That is out of the sequence of life.
Right.
Parents only bury their children during the war, but when it's peaceful, children bury their parents.
Right.
You know, so that's when you are invoking the idea that maybe heaven can speak to me and it's not my gut speaking to me, where it is just an earth biological response, where I do not have to awaken some part of myself to be in touch. This is with organic divinity. Mm. Organic divinity is just in touch because it's the organics of God. I don't have to activate my consciousness. Mm. Because once I do, there's no going back. Mm. So once I begin to utter the higher prayers and enter into the mysteries of, wait a minute, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. Do my choices have consequences that set other things in motion? Then what happens is I have to operate different sensors, so that I have to activate the sensors of a higher set of myself. So instead of feeling gut instinct, which is fundamentally in my stomach, in my lower back, in my colon area, in the coldness of my hands, mm-hmm. my other sensors start animating, things in my heart, the sensors above my waist, my dream state becomes active. Mm-hmm. Heaven has access to my unconscious in a way, to to haunting me, mm-hmm. about decisions I've made in moral language, in ethical language, in my sensitivities to how I am impacting the lives of others in that finely subtle way become animated. They weren't animated when I was operating at my animal instinct.
Right.
That's the difference.
That is incredible. It's a different antenna completely.
Yes.
Absolutely. We were discussing before we started rolling about, I was curious about an archetype, or rather, I would say an imprint. Let's say somebody has a childhood that's just absolute chaos, and I know a few people that had this happen in ways that you wouldn't understand, like a normal being, just incredibly tragic, I guess I would say. But yet they grow up to be very wonderful people. And this could go generations of generations where people, like you say, the war and famines and all these things had trauma everywhere, right? That imprint of trauma, does it follow us always like a cape in systems and reactivating chaos around us unconsciously? Because I know a lot of people who have wonderful, upstanding lives but had traumatic childhood that just seem to bring in a mess, but they don't want to bring in a mess. So I'm wondering if you have some insights with all the work that you do on archetypes, and if the listeners are out there, if you haven't read Archetypes, it's an incredibly eye-opening. Carolyn does classes and workshops and videos galore on archetypes. If you don't know yours, get versed. But is it possible for that imprint to always be with us, or can we try to undo the PTSD that we had as a childhood and get it off of our cape?
Well, the way I would have answered this 5 years ago, 10 years ago, is very different than how I see it now.
Okay.
And, first of all, you're asking about one archetype, mm-hmm. and I no longer would answer, it's about one archetype. It's not. We're more complex than that.
Several, yeah.
Yeah, we're more complex. So somebody who can take, you know, let's read, and let me just say, for those listeners who would say, what's an archetype? For some reason, that word baffles people. So so let's have a
tutorial here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. a tutorial, very crash course here. An archetype is a pattern of power. And even if someone said, what's that? Everybody people watches and they label people.
Yep.
And that's, and a label is a pattern, is an archetype. Mm-hmm. And you could easily, and within a second, you do that. You spot somebody and you say, well, that person's a geek, and I bet that person's a slob, and I bet, these are microchip archetypes. But you do it in a microsecond. And here's the thing, people, I always tell them in my workshops, everybody's picked out five of your archetypes before you chose the seat you're going to sit in my workshop. You think you're the only one doing this when, in fact, you are so obvious to others. You radiate your archetypal patterns. They're oozing out of you like a garlic dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how
great visual.
That is how obvious your patterns are. So your power patterns are that you just, you're screaming them. Mm-hmm. It's the loudest silence you have.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So with that in mind, simple analogies go the best.
Okay.
So think of a chaotic pattern as a language skill.
Mm.
And now you're going to teach a language skill, and you've got 30 students.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say that three of them are geniuses.
Right.
And they are going to learn the language faster than everybody else. Mm-hmm. And you would say, how come they're so good at speaking chaos?
Right.
How come they have such a propensity for it? And these others, I can't keep them awake. They're just calm.
Right.
And no matter how much I insist they learn chaos, they can't do it.
Right.
And these others just have an average chaos. They speak chaos, but in an average way. Mm-hmm. But these three are just geniuses. Why, they're almost savants. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's no different than a language skill.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, you actually almost are better off understanding it outside emotion, outside of the psyche. I mean, outside psychological, emotional. See it as just a pattern that they are very involved with. And I think a person is handicapped by then sinking it into the muck of, oh my God, they're so saturated in their childhood, blah, 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 blah. The chaos pattern is a way of always stirring the energetic dynamics in their field. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people have that on behalf of everyone else they're with.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you don't know why someone carries that pattern. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump has it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Donald Trump has it. Machiavelli had it. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole purpose of the, when someone says it's very a Machiavellian court, it's that intrigue chaos where the idea, the purpose of it was divide and conquer, divide and conquer, keep it chaotic. Sun Tzu in The Art of War says create chaos in your opponent's camp to bring down your enemy.
Right.
So it's really the study of, and what chaos really is a partnership with the energies of change.
So it has nothing to do with character.
Yeah, I mean.
Or does it?
Well, it is. It is susceptible in some sense. And yet, at the same time, Buddha would say, change is constant.
Right.
Okay, change is constant. And there are other people who are in the business of cooperating with change. They initiate discoveries that will, when you discover electricity, you throw the world of candles into chaos.
Sure.
When, you know, certain discoveries, in discovering nuclear energy, we have thrown the world into chaos, and it's never been anything but chaos since.
Got it.
So it's an interesting thing. Now, there are people who exhibit the what chaos is all about and how what brings it into our lives, and it's the inability to reflect on our actions. Mm-hmm. And to bring them to a grounding halt, to make another decision that redirects them.
That is the key right there.
Right there.
More chaos happens because of that inability to ground, reassess,
and, that's,
and act accordingly. That,
and that's all they have to do.
That's it.
That's all they have to do. So they embody something where they are unable to engage its opposite. They're unable to stop that tornadic force.
Interesting.
And it's not that that option's not open to them.
They just can't embrace it vibrationally?
Maybe they don't want to. Maybe it's because somehow or other, and for some, the trauma may be in stopping the chaos because of what's required in stopping the chaos. You can look at someone and say they're too, they don't want to go near their trauma. I don't know that that's true. I think more often than not, they don't. The greater trauma is stopping the flow of chaos.
As many people use their trauma as their identification.
Right.
Also, to create the story and continue the story and thus continue the chaos.
And it's, but it's the power of creating chaos. It's the power of the chaos button.
Okay.
That is their power. It's the power of turning the room upside down that is their power.
So if someone is listening to this and they have someone in their life, whether it's a husband or a brother or a loved one, neighbor, that is this chaos, what do they do to get through it? How can they, is there some sort of skill that they can learn to help maneuver it better, or do they just not tangle with it? Obviously, sometimes that's not an option because of families and you know, who you live with and who you don't. What would you recommend someone do?
Well, there's certain dynamics that are will always cause chaos. One is when you're living with a liar.
Yeah.
That's a chaos button. Two is a narcissist. They will always create chaos.
Yes.
So that's three is someone who has secrets.
Yep.
They will always create chaos. Privacy is essential. Secrets will always create chaos.
And that is at the core of many relationships. And people think, oh, it's okay. It's a white lie. Or it's okay. It's not that big of a deal. But it actually is because it causes leaks in the foundation and chaos.
But also telling lies. Yeah. Accepting lies and telling lies. Lying to yourself. Self-betrayal is a chaos element.
Right, right.
So what you cannot change another person.
No.
You cannot. What you have to decide is what you can live with and what you cannot.
Right.
Because you will never change that other person.
Mm-hmm.
You will not.
Right.
And what you must decide in yourself is what elements you are initiating or in what way you are participating mm-hmm. in chaos. So when somebody lies to you,
yeah,
if you accept that, if you lie with them, if you're lying along with it,
right.
if you rationalize the lie,
you match that vibration,
then you are participating in the creation of chaos in your life.
Interesting.
If you in any way engage, do the chaos dance,
mm-hmm.
then you have to own, I'm living with it. I'm participating in this.
And some of it's learned behavior through survival instincts of childhood, right? If you came from a family of alcoholics, I'm not making excuses. Mm-hmm. I'm saying if you came from a family of alcoholics and you were taught lie to protect daddy, lie to do
sure.
this, lie to, you know, all this
right.
stuff. So then you get out and you're an adult and it's like you're just so used to always telling white lies to make things look better.
Right.
It takes an entire reprogramming and an effort that's really hard, but doable.
Right. And I think one of the great lies
mm-hmm.
is that you can change another person. And at some point, the decision, you know, needs to be made
mm-hmm.
that the what I want to achieve for my own life in terms of how I want to live
mm-hmm.
is up to me. If I want a tranquil environment, then I have to leave this situation. That's all there's to it. And I need to do what's necessary to do that. Mm-hmm. And if it means I have to go from living in a 10-bedroom home to a one-room studio, what is worth more to me? Hiding in 10 bedrooms every different night so that I have 10 bedrooms
right.
and letting a tornado chase me.
Right.
Or sleeping calmly in one room. Even if I have to work two jobs,
right.
I come into a tranquil room. I no longer sleep with a knot in my stomach.
Mm-hmm.
I no longer fear someone blasting into my room in the middle of the night. I no longer am berated. I no longer have to lie to survive.
Mm-hmm.
I would take a closet
right.
over a mansion. And you know me. We are now close friends.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that I mean that.
Absolutely. Yes, you did. And
yeah,
it's
yeah.
true because that means the peace, the inner peace, like you say, in a closet is better than any chaos in a 10-bedroom nightmare.
You can't do it. The rules mm-hmm. of my home
yeah.
begin and end with tranquility.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't allow chaos in my house.
That's right.
It just will not happen. Yeah. So this is where I am as rigorous with what I'm telling your audience as I live it.
True. And that living it is another thing. For those listeners who don't know the specifics of Carolyn's journey, she was a writer and journalist and editor minding her own business when she was hit with the gift of medical intuition. Mm-hmm. But always you were intuitive. You talk about at the age of 7 being able to look into homes and sort of sense it like a bat, like you could mm-hmm. read the homes and what was going on inside the homes. Mm-hmm. And you speak very openly about how your mother, in particular, just welcomed your intuitive mm-hmm. nature
mm-hmm.
as a completely normal thing. And a lot of people listening might not have had that.
Yeah, I was, you know, it was always so ordinary. Thank you for that, Mom. Mm-hmm. You know, but more, you know, more than ordinary, it was fun.
Right.
But in addition to that, I was educated by nuns and priests mm-hmm. and who were not either violent or violating. I'm one of those Catholics who was very blessed by my education, by scholars mm-hmm. and people devoted to the passing on of knowledge and prayer.
Yes.
And so for me, I and this was true all the way through to the age of 29, all my graduate school years and postgrad, and so I can honestly say that I was educated by scholars and mystics,
yep.
even to astrology.
Yeah.
And so I found that I credit everything to having been educated in an atmosphere where being called to prayer was as vital to me as being called to study.
Mm-hmm.
And as learning about the elegance of high tea, all of this went together in the formality of the undergrad school I went to, for example. But it wasn't just about intuition. Mm-hmm. It wasn't put in those terms. It was put in the approach of what is the skill of the mystic.
Right.
Because I remember how many times we went into prayer for someone who was ill.
Right.
The time that Sister Olive had a brain tumor. Mm. And the nuns went, and the college I went to has a chapel where it goes back to 1856 or something, where someone has always, where a nun, not someone, a nun has always been in prayer.
Wow.
It has been occupied by someone praying, a sister praying.
Imagine the vibration of that chapel.
It has been open.
Wow.
And when I was a student, I used to think, is that true? And you know, one time I was there, I set my alarm when I was a senior. I finally thought, I have to check this out before I graduate.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I went through the aspirancy and I came in so they didn't, and it went, didn't go through the front door. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, yeah, there it was, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Someone was praying.
A sister was praying. Mm. And of course, this chapel was banned from male men. Mm-hmm. This was for the sisters and mm-hmm. the students. But it, that moment was so holy for me.
Sure.
Was so holy. And when I go into prayer to this day, I am visually in that chapel.
Absolutely.
You know, I am in that chapel. And you know, the foundress of that community was 5 years ago canonized, the eighth American saint, because healings happen there now. A man who was blind and it cataracts over his eyes. He still has those cataracts and he has 20/20 vision.
Now, this is incredible. You talk about a healing and you say that we can't change another, right? And yet you've experienced, you've seen, you've witnessed, you've helped people heal. These people come to your workshops. They have arthritis and then they leave healed. And we talked about this once on why people cannot hold the vibration of a healing when they go back into life, right? They go back home and they've got a skeptic in the household who says, you can't have some woman talk at you and heal your arthritis. What are you, crazy? Da, da, da. And so while he's not changing her, he's influencing her vibration and bringing down the miraculous heal. No?
I would say it differently.
Oh, tell me.
But you bring up such a good point, but yes. I would say it differently.
Okay, tell me.
How I would put it is this, and that's that one of the, as a medical intuitive, what I learned, as my career kind of began as a medical intuitive. Mm-hmm. But today I would say I'm more of a mystic out of a monastery who happens to have that skill as a medical intuitive.
Yeah.
And I began there, but I ended up here mm-hmm. as more of a mystic who's now
a teacher and author.
A teacher and knows about the holy arts.
I see.
Of healing.
Okay.
And I think of myself more there. But what took me along these path, this mm-hmm. long, long path of that's 38 years old now, 38 years long, was I started out wondering about, you know, what, how does medical intuition, what is the skill I have and how does it work? And then charting, you know, how people lose power. Even the language I used was so basic. I didn't know about chakras and all of that. And my focus was on doing readings. And even the language, when I look back, that I used was almost so rudimentary.
Give me an example. Like if somebody had a,
you know,
throat
I would
cancer.
Say, that was my first reading, Jen.
Really?
That was my very first reading.
Oh, okay.
That was my first reading with Norm Shealy. Mm-hmm. He called and I didn't even know anatomy. Well, and I said, this man feels like he has concrete in his throat.
Mm. Wow. Norm Shealy, doctor, Harvard educated brain surgeon.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was it. I said, he has concrete in his throat.
Yeah.
Anyway, eventually, you know, I would start speaking in anatomical terms. Well, you know, he's got a pressure in his heart chamber. And so it was basic language. And then mm-hmm. Norm would say, do you know why? Hmm. And I'd say, and I would start getting impressions. Well, he's got this going on in his life. So then I started to tie one thing left to another. And then eventually, where I became good, mm-hmm. helpful, rather, was that I could see the illness forming, coming in, which is where medicine could not pick it up. There was no blood test that could pick it up, no urine test. And I'd say, Norm, this person's going to have this illness. He's got 3 months, 6 months, whatever it is, because it's coming in. Mm. And this is the pattern or patterns. And if he could deal with these patterns, he's got a chance of reversing this. Okay, then eventually, I began to understand the power of thought and energy. And okay, then as that progressed, nowhere along the line was I interested in healing. Or then I thought about healing.
Right.
Because Norm would say, what can they do to heal this? And I thought, I don't know. And then I started to wonder, what can they do?
Right.
Okay. So then as I asked those questions, that body of work began to talk to me.
Right.
And then I thought, how come people aren't more active about, why don't people want to heal?
Right.
So then that body of work began to talk mm-hmm. to me. So then I got through that body of work. And then I thought, there's got to be more to that. There's got to be more here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're more complicated than it's simple as either it's positive or negative energy. It's got to be more than this. And then the body of archetypes opened up.
Right.
Okay, so then that happened. But with archetypes, and I was there studying that 18 years.
Right.
Then I thought, you know, this is fine and this is rich, and everybody needs to know their archetypal patterns. They have to, because they enter into the impersonal realm there, but still. That did not address.
Mm-hmm.
This does not address suffering. Now I'm getting into the subtle suffering. With archetypes, you get into power patterns. But now I'm getting into the subtle fiber of the human being. How come people suffer? What is that about? What is this inability to forgive? What is the subtle tissue of human nature? Enter Teresa.
Teresa Vavala.
Now my life shifts and I move into my mystical experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Uninvited, I might add. The open door for me was a grand mal seizure.
Exactly. And here you are on deadline for a book, and boom, grand mal.
And I start going into the deep mystical waters.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm looking at human beings thinking, you're not in pain, you're suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even know where you are.
Right.
You don't even know what's happening to you. And you don't even get the world behind your eye. You don't even have the vocabulary to access. You're not suffering because of guilt. You have sinned against another person, and because what you have done, you've did knowingly. You knowingly harmed that person, and you don't even get that guilt is the knowing act of harming another.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't clean yourself out because you are not using the word sin. You're not saying, I did this knowingly.
Mm-hmm.
This is harming the soul. All right. Pursuing.
Yeah.
From here, I began to see the force humiliation and the fear of being humiliated had on not just the ego, but how the fear of being humiliated prevented a person from praying.
Interesting.
Now, let's go to God.
Oh.
Now the route takes us to God, which is, show me, take me down deep.
Mm-hmm.
And show me the reason for which you gave me life.
Right.
Take me down deep. Why did you give me this life? If you're afraid of being humiliated,
you can't be humble.
How can you handle that revelation?
Right.
What is the real key to self-esteem?
Mm.
To clear guidance. It's self-esteem.
Right.
To esteem one's self so that you do not fear being humiliated so that you can have an experience so profound that you do not need the validation of another person, so that you can exist within such a profound experience like healing outside the speed of an ordinary person, so that when others come up to you and say, it's not possible that this happened, It's not possible. I'm sorry, but it's not possible.
Right.
That you can stand in the truth of what you've experienced in your body. This cancer did heal. Mm-hmm. I did have this cancer, and now I don't.
Right.
And I don't need you to validate this. In fact, I don't even need to tell you about it.
Right.
I can experience something so profound and keep it under my vow of silence.
Right.
I don't need to say that. Because if you're weak and you need validation, you will bring it like pearl before swine.
Yes.
And you will put it out there and say, see what happened to me. And when others who are intimidated by that type of intimacy with God will say to you, you unworthy thing, you must be insane. I know you never had cancer in the first place.
Right.
As they often do. She must have never even had that disease.
Right.
And then what happens? You develop a different kind of disease.
Right.
You develop anger.
Right.
You develop resentment that they would think you are not good enough for such. Now you're even sicker than you were before, but now it's a different type of sickness. So it is better in the wisdom of God that you get denied that experience entirely.
You know, it's so funny as you're saying this, I'm thinking about the pettiness of a recent encounter we just had in the hallway where I was feeling not validated by a certain something with a colleague. And I was expressing, well, why didn't this person validate? And the mirror goes back to me. I have to always validate me. It's not about, now there's sometimes where things are unjust and unfair, and yet we have to be able to fill up our own container and not need that validation, no matter what form it comes in, from a parent, from a spouse, from the dog licking our feet. We have to self-first it. We really do. And so thank you for that reminder. Always giving me the reminders. You know, you mentioned God many times, and for those who are listening, if they aren't particularly devoted to a certain religion, you talk very devoutly about being Catholic, and yet you also speak openly about those who have messed up the message of Jesus. How can we, you know, you say Jesus is all loving, and you
I do?
Well, here's what you said. Hold on, let me get out here. Psychics, Healers, and Mediums, Chapter 8, Carolyn, is the featured chapter of my latest book, and you talk about, well, first of all, there's so many things you talk about, but we were talking about God, and you were talking about as a God-loving woman and as a Christian, and as a Catholic, rather, I should say, that you were discussing how people have completely messed up the message of Jesus, and that by doing so, they are killing over him, and they are... they're out of alignment about that. And it's unfortunate that somebody as loving, here we go. So I get to say this. This is a mythology that there is this off planet God. And if you're really close to God, God will take your money and make you suffer. And it's like we play this really coy game with spirituality. This is you, where you want to pray, but not that much. The other reason that people do this is because they want to retain their relationship with darkness because it's convenient and it works. People do not trust light. They trust darkness. They want to make sure they can still lie and do things in the dark. Whereas if you decide to really tune into your intuition, really fast, you've got it. You own it. I heard that. I'm clear. When you stay in the darkness, you can say, I'm not so sure. And then you do whatever you want. People do not like the light. There's no buzz in it. It's not erotic. Darkness is erotic. There's a buzz. And what we have is a fear of the light, just like you have a fear of being fully healthy. And then I say, why would people fear being fully healthy? And you say, the fear is that once you're healthy, you cannot be vulnerable. Once you're healthy, you cannot go into your excuses. And you can never ask for help. You can be asked for help, but you cannot be vulnerable. Once you're fully healthy, then any kind of fragility is not allowed, and that capacity to need someone is going to go away. Words of wisdom from Carolyn.
That's right.
But, you know, this off-planet God of punishment and sin is the core of what many Catholics that I know believe, and the fear of if I don't pray enough and do enough Hail Marys, then I'm not okay in God's eyes. How did we mess that up?
Well,
how do we get back to the core of the message of what it was found, how it was found?
You know, in many ways, I think we can't ourselves, which is why I think the whole system's coming down.
Interesting.
You know, I think the message, the theology of all the churches, all the religious systems, all the religious systems are coming down. You know, the Dalai Lama said he's not reincarnating.
Mm-hmm.
I am in my mind Buddhist. In my heart, I'm Christian. Mm-hmm. And much of me is aligned to. I don't have a religion, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I had a religion, it would be the cosmic laws.
Sure.
You know, all of the religions are coming down because it's their time now to come down. Who we are, how we need to live,
mm-hmm.
how we need to survive, and what's required to survive cannot be sustained by the teachings of religions anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Religions no longer have a message that is capable of supporting the evolution of humanity. All of the religions teach superior, like especially the three Abrahamic religions,
mm-hmm.
All of which share the message of being a chosen person, being the chosen religion,
mm-hmm.
and they are killing over that. And there's no, you know, that is all mythic. Mm-hmm. Okay, so all three of those religions, we are now at war. We are now on the precipice of whether or not we can disengage from those ridiculous myths about real estate in the Middle East that supposedly came from a god with a deed that no one can find,
mm-hmm.
and a story of a half-god, half-man messiah, and the third with a jihad-breathing prophet,
mm-hmm.
who gives permission to bring destruction on everybody who doesn't believe in that religion.
With rewards of 40 virgins.
70.
70. Sorry. Golly, can't forget the other 30.
Right, right. And all three are mm-hmm. nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this planet can't sustain any of these myths anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It just can't. They all have to come down. So we have two popes in the Vatican. We have a Dalai Lama who says he's not coming back. We have all kinds of things happening
mm-hmm.
that show that the decay of mythologies. We have empty churches, empty synagogues. We have violations of the core teachings mm-hmm. of each of these religions constantly,
mm-hmm.
constantly. The fundamentalism in any of its forms is an absolute violation of the teachings, of the high mystical teachings of a religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's the war zone. It's the war zone. It's deciding to use the name of their god to kill others. And that's where most of their population is now going,
mm-hmm.
away from the high mystical teachings and into the trenches. The highest population for any of these religions is in the war zone,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Right.
So it shows you that you go to the fundamentalism when it's not surviving, and it's the fundamentalists that go to the bunkers and say, you know, bunker in and let's kill everybody that's trying to bring change because change is coming.
Right.
So when you say, what can we do this progression, we're in the most vulnerable time of all. In fact, we are in the greatest turning point in the history of civilization, Jen.
Right now.
The history of civilization. That's a huge sentence, and I'm a wordsmith like you, and
yeah.
I choose my words very, very carefully.
And,
the
yes.
history of civilized people. So we see the rise of barbarianism mm-hmm. everywhere. We see the rise of country against country and citizen against citizen. We're going backwards, not forward. We see that we have become a country that has no idea what its values are.
Mm-hmm.
No idea. So they're going backwards to values they once had, thinking that will salvage a country that is rapidly spinning out of control.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go backwards. We'll go to values that had before the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
We will do, because we cannot imagine ourselves as a country that has to participate in global cooperation. We have no template for that, because we've always been the country that's dictated the rules.
Right.
So we cannot imagine ourselves actually cooperating,
right,
actually not dictating, except that. So now what we've done is we've had a steady group of leaders who have disemboweled the self-respect, the high moral ground this country once held. Mm-hmm. So we are going to be picked up off the ground floor.
True.
As the rest of the world progresses toward unity, we are flailing
in isolation
with an absolute lunatic. Mm-hmm. An absolute lunatic at the helm. And a Congress too weak and spineless to take Caligula
right
out of the White House.
And do you think even that is divine? I've interviewed a lot of people who think we had to get this far into this chaotic state to make the change and have the pendulum swing the other way. Did it have to go like this?
Well, I think with every decision, a path opens up. You can take the wisdom one or the woe.
Right.
And I think pride and fear always ends up with the woe or the fate path versus the destiny or the wisdom.
Right.
If we had an option in Hillary,
mm-hmm,
okay, and while all these people may be saying, Hillary, blah, 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 and start
right
gagging.
Right.
What you had there was a choice of, I see with, for all the flaws,
mm-hmm,
if you put the two together, for all the flaws, and there were many, nobody sat back and said, have we ever had perfect politicians? Have we ever had perfect anything?
Right.
Have we ever had politicians who haven't lied in this? And in fact, aren't we living in the age of lies?
Mm-hmm.
Aren't we living in an age of endless liars? Who hasn't lied?
Right.
Where are these people? Am I not a liar? Is this not the age of liars?
But even our founding fathers were pinning the stories of Hamilton, right? Hamilton and Jefferson using to fight with each other always.
At the end of the day,
mm-hmm,
how much of this was about, I just can't picture a woman at the helm of the United States.
Right.
I just can't picture it. I would rather have a lying, misogynist man who really was an unsuccessful businessman.
Right.
Who cheated people at the university with that Trump University, who cheated people all the time, who bankrupts companies to make money, who had 3,600 lawsuits against him, I believe, before all the things that came out about him constantly to her email thing.
Do you think this matched the vibration of our country more than we know? Because
yes,
that's really what happened was,
yeah,
is the leader,
yeah,
that was chosen was the majority, yeah, of the vibration of this country.
Well, you know, I think what Trump did in many ways was he brought out the dark underbelly of our country. And now he is the dark underbelly.
Right.
He is that. He. It's amazing to me what he brought out.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, let me add something. When I see these people, these Trump supporters, you know, my heart hurts for them. And I'll tell you why. These are, first of all, my fellow Americans. Mm-hmm. These are my fellow Americans. And I heard an interview during the Right after Trump got in, I think, when people were trying to deal with the, how the heck did he get in, right?
Mm-hmm.
But these people, this young man was talking, he had a family,
mm-hmm,
I think it's West Virginia, and he was saying, and he was from a town that, it's like a ghost town now, a ghost town. And he said,
it was a mining community, I think.
Was it a mining community? Could have been mining. Yes,
yeah,
it was probably mining.
Yeah.
And he says, And he said that he'd try anything for a job, anything. Right. He said, I'm trying to support my family.
Right.
And he talked about how he and his friend had gotten, you know, had had three jobs in 1 year, would do anything. And he said, you know, he gets a job and they were so happy. And he was out of the job in 6 weeks. And in the despair of being released from a job yet again, and the despair of the man firing him, mm-hmm. letting him go. And he said, at least Trump came here. And Trump said, I'm gonna get you out of this. Mm-hmm. And he said, I would have voted for anybody who came here, looked me in the eye and said, I'll help you. Right. And he said, all I wanted was that hope.
Right.
And he said, if Hillary would come here, I'd have voted for her.
Right.
My heart hurt for them. And here's the thing. What I really understood in that moment was that how much progress, how much that technology has moved so much of our world exponentially away from the world of the people of the hands, mm. the people of the earth, the people who earn their living by working with their hands and like that.
The natural resources.
The
of
natural
the century,
resources
yeah.
mm-hmm. that are being rapidly replaced mm-hmm. and who haven't tooled up to keep up. And there's a hostility toward educated people, mm-hmm. as you know, that Bush brought out, mm-hmm. as we would laugh about his low educational.
Nuclear.
Right, right. right. Well, but, you yeah. know, mm-hmm. And yet, what I also understood in that moment was, you know, when I went to college or my brothers and my family or whatever, so many people, and it did not represent a weakening of my family. Because, you know, I could get a job in Chicago, mm-hmm. right? You could get a job in Chicago where your family was from. Mm-hmm. But if they sent their child to college in that small town, not only would they lose their child because there was no college job in that small town, but they would lose their child culturally.
Sure.
Because that child would come back and never relate to them culturally again. And then no doubt marry someone who was not like them at all. Mm-hmm. And they would, maybe they would even, he might even marry a woman from the North, God forbid.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But that would change the dynamic of their country. They their family, they would lose their son mm-hmm. or daughter with education.
Right.
So it's the enemy of their small enclave of culture and their progress. So when someone comes in and says, I will make sure that you never have to leave your town, mm-hmm. that nothing will change, that you can hold on to each other, that you don't have to get an education, that you can just stay put, mm-hmm. they're going to hold on to that big lie
right.
as long as they can.
We talked about the power of forgiveness earlier, and that bad things happen to good people. We can't control what happens to us, but we can control how we react to what happens with us. I want to wrap things up with the story of David Paladin that you shared, the Navajo who had incredible struggles when he was in the war. If you could share that with our listeners, I think that would be very beneficial.
Oh, I don't even know how far back to go because that's a long story.
Well, he was in the war. He was
in the war, and he was
a Navajo.
He was a Navajo, and he went. And David told me the story himself.
Yes.
And I met him at Council Grove, Kansas, around 1984. And he was also an artist. And David, I'll never forget him telling me this. He was smoking a cigarette, and he was kind of laughing like, well, I have kind of a hell of a story. And when he left the reservation as a young man, joined the Merchant Marine, lied about his age. Mm-hmm. And met other young men who had joined the Merchant Marines, and he
wasn't he an alcoholic at very young
yes,
age?
Yes, he was an alcoholic, and I guess he got involved in international, you know, jumped on international boats, and you know, and there he met young men from Europe who he had done the same thing, and the ships were sailing around the South Seas, and there he saw, and this is in the 1930s.
Okay.
And he saw that the Japanese were, you know, kind of moving their armadas around there, and they had invaded the Philippines, and they had gone into you know, they were invading China and that, and he was drawing what he was seeing.
Hmm.
He got back to the United States. He turned the drawings in. And interestingly enough, he didn't become a wind talker mm-hmm. and join the he joined the army
hmm.
and he went to Europe.
Okay.
Anyway, he was caught. He was caught.
He was captured by the Germans?
He was captured by the Germans. Mm-hmm. And they tortured him. Of course, he didn't look like an American soldier, particularly because he was a Navajo. He had very much the Indian look about him. And they nailed his feet to the floor. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really tortured him.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were going to send him to a concentration camp. They did not send him to a German POW.
POW, yeah.
And as they were kind of dragging him on the train to ship him out, the guard that was dragging him was the guard that had been with him as a merchant marine friend.
He remembered
him.
And
he remembered him. And somehow that, he got him off. And got him sent and said, this is an American soldier. We can't do this. And how he had the clout to do that, who knows. But David ended up in a POW camp and in and out of delirium and et cetera, et cetera. One of the guards there apparently took leeches and used it on his wounds, et cetera, et cetera. But that terrified. He was however it is he remembered it. Anyway, at the
trauma.
End of the war, mm-hmm. yeah, the end of the war, he was shipped back home. He was crippled, and he ended up in a veterans hospital where he spent the next two or 2.5 years of his life. And then he decided that he would go back to his reservation and say goodbye to his people, then return and just live his life out at the reservation because he couldn't walk and he mm-hmm. couldn't even imagine what would he do because he had no education formally and, you know.
Right.
So he makes his way back to Nevada.
To the reservation.
Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And he said as he kind of was dragging himself back to the reservation, his people had seen him. This was the first time in 10 or 12 years.
Mm.
And he had crutches and mm-hmm. et cetera. And they said, Chetley, what happened to you? And he said, in my people, they listen to you tell your story 3 times and that's it. Mm-hmm. They give you 3 times to get your spirit back. You tell the story 3 times to a circle of elders.
And why is the number 3 significant?
That's
the thing.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's 3 times.
Okay.
Because it obviously is 3 times.
And after the third, if you say it more, it then harms you instead of heals you.
Their belief was if you tell it a 4th time, you start sending your spirit out again.
Mm-hmm.
So they listen 3 times. Not to comment, mm-hmm. not to this. Their role is as you're listening, they're praying to help you pull it back.
Bring your spirit back.
Bring your spirit back.
Help you
Bring
heal.
It. Mm-hmm. Help you hear. And they mm-hmm. are witnessing. They are the sacred witnesses.
Got it.
They want to validate. This is the journey you've had. This is the journey you've had. And their job while you are telling your story is to pray and help you bring your spirit back. They're calling your spirit back mm-hmm. as you tell your story.
Got it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's not important to know why 3. Who cares? It's 3.
I'm curious yeah. the significance of the number.
And
so he was sitting with
it
the
didn't
elders.
Work. He couldn't walk afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So they took him and they tied a rope around his waist, and they said, "Your spirit's not back, and you, no man lives this way. You can't live this way. What you are hollow."
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "Then we have to let you go, or now you do this." And they threw him into very deep, cold water. And they said, either you call your spirit back here or we will let you go because no one lives without a spirit. It is not possible to walk the earth empty. To walk the earth empty.
Mm-hmm.
And they let him go. And he said it was harder for him in that water to call his spirit back, to make his spirit come back into his body that was so angry, so bitter, so full of pain.
Mm-hmm.
and to say to his spirit, no, you have to come in now and resurrect me. You have to, because the conditions upon which his spirit would come in is that you let that pain go or I'm not coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So right there in that cold water, the negotiation, the contract was made.
Mm-hmm.
I will let it go. Well, then let it go, because I will not come into that body.
Right.
And so he had to consciously there in the water say, I forgive that guard. And then the guard said to him, I was trying to save your life. I had no medicine, but the maggots were eating the disease.
Right.
One after another, he saw the higher purpose of what had been done.
Right.
And he wept in the cold water, and his spirit came back in, and he got his legs. And he became a minister and a shaman and a holy man. And one of the greatest privileges of my life was to know him.
And a very beautiful painter as well.
Yes, I have a painting in my, and he made me a medicine stick.
Wow.
It's still on my desk. David passed away.
Wow.
In 1989.
So for all who are listening, call your spirit back.
Yeah.
Call your spirit back. Let go. You're not condoning all those guards that put leeches on your feet. You're not condoning the bad things that have happened, but you are.
Oh, stop coddling.
You're letting it
just
go. Let it go.
Call your spirit back. Stop coddling people.
And that's what I love about Carolyn and her wisdom. As I sat and watched her address a woman in the workshop who said, what do I do if I have more than one sacred contract? And you looked at her and said, you want people taking care of you. You need to get off your rump, go for a walk, da-da-da-da-da-da, because that was it. This woman was entitled and apathetic and all these things, as many of us are, walking around wanting someone to serve it up and do it for us. And at the end of the day, people, we have to do it for us. So thank you, Carolyn Mace. For all you who are out there and want to get one of her workshops, go see her in person. Go travel with her to Europe. Go to France. Go to England. There's many options.
Montserrat. I'm doing a workshop at Montserrat in Spain.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Explain that one.
We got the monastery to ourselves. I know. That's pretty extraordinary.
And that is at myss.com. Click on mace.com, find out all the information, get one of Carolyn's many books, but importantly, just stay in dialogue. Go to the website, you can do the blog, the email, the newsletters, all of your, even the TED Talks that you find with Carolyn are worth it. It's worth its weight in gold, and I'm so grateful for all that you put out and all that you've done, and especially for the last hour and change of your time. Thank you, Carolyn.
My pleasure.
To everybody out there, please stay spiritual, damn it. I'm Jennifer Weigel, and we'll talk with you next time.